A dispatch from Fubai in April 1972 said that 50 GIs out of 142 men in the company refused to go on patrol, crying, "This isn't our war." The New York Times on July 14, 1973, reported that American prisoners of war in Vietnam, ordered by officers in the POW camp to stop cooperating with the enemy, shouted back, "Who's the enemy?" They formed a peace committee in the camp, and a sergeant on the committee later recalled his march from capture to the POW camp. Until we first got to the camp, we didn't see a village intact. They were all destroyed. I sat down and put myself in the middle and asked myself, is this right or wrong? Is it right to destroy villages? Is it right to kill people en masse? After a while, it just got to me. Pentagon officials in Washington and Navy spokesmen in San Diego announced after the United States withdrew its troops from Vietnam in 1973 that the Navy was going to purge itself of undesirables, and that these included as many as 6,000 men in the Pacific Fleet, a substantial proportion of them black. Altogether, about 700,000 GIs had received less than honorable discharges. In the year 1973, one of every five discharges was less than honorable, indicating something less than dutiful obedience to the military. By 1971, 177 of every 1,000 American soldiers were listed as absent without leave, some of them three or four times. Deserters doubled from 47,000 in 1967 to 89,000 in 1971. One of those who stayed, fought, but then turned against the war was Ron Kovic. His father worked in a supermarket on Long Island. In 1963, at the age of 17, he enlisted in the Marines. 2 years later, in Vietnam, at the age of 19, his spine was shattered by shell fire. Paralyzed from the waist down, he was put in a wheelchair. Back in the States, he observed the brutal treatment of wounded veterans in the veterans' hospitals, thought more and more about the war, and joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He went to demonstrations to speak against the war. One evening, he heard actor Donald Sutherland read from the post-World War I novel by Dalton Trumbo, Johnny Got His Gun, about a soldier whose limbs and face were shot away by gunfire, a thinking torso who invented a way of communicating with the outside world and then beat out a message so powerful it could not be heard without trembling. Sutherland began to read the passage, and something I will never forget swept over me. It was as if someone was speaking for everything I ever went through in the hospital. I began to shake, and I remember there were tears in my eyes. Kovic demonstrated against the war and was arrested. He tells his story in Born on the 4th of July. They help me back into the chair and take me to another part of the prison building to be booked. "What's your name?" the officer behind the desk says. "Ron Kovic," I say. "Occupation, Vietnam veteran against the war." "What?" he says sarcastically, looking down at me. "I'm a Vietnam veteran against the war," I almost shout back. "You should have died over there," he says. He turns to his assistant. "I'd like to take this guy and throw him off the roof." They fingerprint me and take my picture and put me in a cell. I've begun to wet my pants like a little baby. The tube has slipped out during my examination by the doctor. I try to fall asleep, but even though I am exhausted, the anger is alive in me like a huge hot stone in my chest. I lean my head up against the wall and listen to the toilets flush again and again. Kovic and the other veterans drove to Miami to the Republican National Convention in 1972, went into the convention hall, wheeled themselves down the aisles, and as Nixon began his acceptance speech, shouted, "Stop the bombing, stop the war." Delegates cursed them, traitor, and Secret Service men hustled them out of the hall. In the fall of 1973, with no victory in sight and North Vietnamese troops entrenched in various parts of the South, the United States agreed to accept a settlement that would withdraw American troops and leave the revolutionary troops where they were until a new elected government would be set up, including communist and non-communist elements. But the Saigon government refused to agree, and the United States decided to make one final attempt to bludgeon the North Vietnamese into submission. It sent waves of B-52s over Hanoi and Haiphong, destroying homes and hospitals, killing unknown numbers of civilians. The attack did not work. Many of the B-52s were shot down. there was angry protest all over the world, and Kissinger went back to Paris and signed very much the same peace agreement that had been agreed on before. The United States withdrew its forces, continuing to give aid to the Saigon government. But when the North Vietnamese launched attacks in early 1975 against the major cities in South Vietnam, the government collapsed. In late April 1975, North Vietnamese troops entered Saigon. The American embassy staff fled, along with many Vietnamese who feared communist rule, and the long war in Vietnam was over. Saigon was renamed Ho Chi Minh City, and both parts of Vietnam were unified as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Traditional history portrays the end of wars as coming from the initiatives of leaders' negotiations in Paris or Brussels or Geneva or Versailles, just as it often finds the coming of war a response to the demand of the people. The Vietnam War gave clear evidence that at least for that war, making one wonder about the others, the political leaders were the last to take steps to end the war. The people were far ahead. The president was always far behind. The Supreme Court silently turned away from cases challenging the constitutionality of the war. Congress was years behind public opinion. In the spring of 1971, syndicated columnists Roland Evans and Robert Novak, two firm supporters of the war, wrote regretfully of a sudden outbreak of anti-war emotionalism in the House of Representatives and said, "The anti-war animosities now suddenly so pervasive among House Democrats are viewed by administration backers as less anti-Nixon than as a response to constituent pressures." It was only after the intervention in Cambodia ended, and only after the nationwide campus uproar over that invasion, that Congress passed a resolution declaring that American troops should not be sent into Cambodia without its approval. And it was not until late 1973, when American troops had finally been removed from Vietnam, that Congress passed a bill limiting the power of the president to make war without congressional consent. Even there, in that War Powers Resolution, the president could make war for 60 days on his own without a congressional declaration. The administration tried to persuade the American people that the war was ending because of its decision to negotiate a peace, not because it was losing the war, not because of the powerful anti-war movement in the United States. But the government's own secret memoranda all through the war testify to its sensitivity at each stage about public opinion in the United States and abroad. The data is in the Pentagon Papers. In June of 1964, top American military and State Department officials, including Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, met in Honolulu. Rusk stated that public opinion on our Southeast Asia policy was badly divided and that, therefore, the president needed an affirmation of support. Diem had been replaced by a general named Khan. The Pentagon historians write, "Upon his return to Saigon on June 5th, Ambassador Lodge went straight from the airport to call on General Khan. The main thrust of his talk with Khan was to hint that the United States government would, in the immediate future, be preparing U.S. public opinion for actions against North Vietnam." 2 months later came the Gulf of Tonkin affair. On April 2, 1965, a memo from CIA Director John McCone suggested that the bombing of North Vietnam be increased because it was not sufficiently severe to change North Vietnam's policy. On the other hand, we can expect increasing pressure to stop the bombing from various elements of the American public, from the press, the United Nations, and world opinion. The U.S. should try for a fast knockout before this opinion could build up, McCone said. Assistant Secretary of Defense John McNaughton's memo of early 1966 suggested destruction of locks and dams to create mass starvation because strikes at population targets would create a counterproductive wave of revulsion abroad and at home. In May 1967, the Pentagon historians write, "McNaughton was also very deeply concerned about the breadth and intensity of public unrest and dissatisfaction with the war, especially with young people, the underprivileged, the intelligentsia, and the women." McNaughton worried, "Will the move to call up 20,000 reserves polarize opinion to the extent that the doves in the United States will get out of hand, massive refusals to serve or to fight or to cooperate, or worse. He warned, "There may be a limit beyond which many Americans and much of the world will not permit the United States to go. The picture of the world's greatest superpower killing or seriously injuring 1,000 non-combatants a week while trying to pound a tiny backward nation into submission on an issue whose merits are hotly disputed is not a pretty one. It could conceivably produce a costly distortion in the American national consciousness." That costly distortion seems to have taken place by the spring of 1968, when, with the sudden and scary Tet Offensive of the National Liberation Front, Westmoreland asked President Johnson to send him 200,000 more troops on top of the 525,000 already there. Johnson asked a small group of action officers in the Pentagon to advise him on this. They studied the situation and concluded that 200,000 troops would totally Americanize the war and would not strengthen the Saigon government because the Saigon leadership shows no signs of a willingness, let alone an ability, to attract the necessary loyalty or support of the people. Furthermore, the report said, sending troops would mean mobilizing reserves, increasing the military budget. There would be more U.S. casualties, more taxes, and this growing disaffection, accompanied, as it certainly will be, by increased defiance of the draft and growing unrest in the cities because of the belief that we are neglecting domestic problems, runs great risks of provoking a domestic crisis of unprecedented proportions. The growing unrest in the cities must have been a reference to the black uprisings that had taken place in 1967 and showed the link, whether blacks deliberately made it or not, between the war abroad and poverty at home. The evidence from the Pentagon Papers is clear that Johnson's decision in the spring of 1968 to turn down Westmoreland's request to slow down for the first time the escalation of the war, to diminish the bombing, to go to the conference table, was influenced to a great extent by the actions Americans had taken in demonstrating their opposition to the war. When Nixon took office, he too tried to persuade the public that protest would not affect him, but he almost went berserk when one lone pacifist picketed the White House. The frenzy of Nixon's actions against dissidents, plans for burglaries, wiretapping, mail openings, suggest the importance of the anti-war movement in the minds of national leaders. One sign that the ideas of the anti-war movement had taken hold in the American public was that juries became more reluctant to convict anti-war protesters, and local judges, too, were treating them differently. In Washington, by 1971, judges were dismissing charges against demonstrators in cases where 2 years before they almost certainly would have been sent to jail. The anti-war groups who had raided draft boards, the Baltimore Four, the Catonsville Nine, the Milwaukee 14, the Boston Five, and more, were receiving lighter sentences for the same crimes. The last group of draft board raiders, the Camden 28, were priests, nuns, and laypeople who raided a draft board in Camden, New Jersey, in August 1971. It was essentially what the Baltimore Four had done 4 years earlier, when all were convicted and Phil Berrigan got 6 years in prison. But in this instance, the Camden defendants were acquitted by the jury on all counts. When the verdict was in, one of the jurors, a 53-year-old black taxi driver from Atlantic City named Samuel Braithwaite, who had spent 11 years in the Army, left a letter for the defendants. "To you, the clerical physicians, with your God-given talents, I say well done. Well done for trying to heal the sick, irresponsible men, men who were chosen by the people to govern and lead them. These men who failed the people by raining death and destruction on a hapless country. You went out to do your part while your brothers remained in their ivory towers watching. And hopefully someday in the near future, peace and harmony may reign to people of all nations." That was in May of 1973. The American troops were leaving Vietnam. C.L. Sulzberger, the New York Times correspondent, a man close to the government, wrote, "The U.S. emerges as the big loser, and history books must admit this. We lost the war in the Mississippi Valley, not the Mekong Valley. Successive American governments were never able to muster the necessary mass support at home." In fact, the United States had lost the war in both the Mekong Valley and the Mississippi Valley. It was the first clear defeat to the global American empire formed after World War II. It was administered by revolutionary peasants abroad and by an astonishing movement of protest at home. Back on September 26, 1969, President Richard Nixon, noting the growing anti-war activity all over the country, announced that, "Under no circumstance will I be affected, whatever, by it." But 9 years later, in his memoirs, he admitted that the anti-war movement caused him to drop plans for an intensification of the war. "Although publicly I continued to ignore the raging anti-war controversy, I knew, however, that after all the protests anti the moratorium, American public opinion would be seriously divided by any military escalation of the war." It was a rare presidential admission of the power of public protest. From a long-range viewpoint, something perhaps even more important had happened. The rebellion at home was spreading beyond the issue of war in Vietnam. Helen Keller had said in 1911, "We vote? What does that mean?" And Emma Goldman around the same time, "Our modern fetish is universal suffrage." After 1920, women were voting as men did, and their subordinate condition had hardly changed. Right after women got the vote, the measure of their social progress can be seen in an advice column written by Dorothy Dix that appeared in newspapers all over the country. The woman should not be merely a domestic drudge, she said. A man's wife is the show window where he exhibits the measure of his achievement. The biggest deals are put across over luncheon tables. We meet at dinner the people who can push our fortunes. The woman who cultivates a circle of worthwhile people, who belongs to clubs, who makes herself interesting and agreeable, is a help to her husband. Robert and Helen Lind, studying Muncie, Indiana in the late 20s, noted the importance of good looks and dress in the assessment of women. Also, they found that when men spoke frankly among themselves, they were likely to speak of women as creatures purer and morally better than men, but as relatively impractical, emotional, unstable, given to prejudice, easily hurt, and largely incapable of facing facts or doing hard thinking. A writer in early 1930, boosting the beauty business, started off a magazine article with the sentence, "The average American woman has 16 square feet of skin." He went on to say that there were 40,000 beauty shops in the country and that $2 billion was spent each year on cosmetics for women, but this was insufficient. American women are not yet spending even one-fifth of the amount necessary to improve their appearance. He then gave an itemized list of the annual beauty needs of every woman: 12 hot oil treatments, 52 facials, 26 eyebrow plucks, etc. It seems that women have been best able to make their first escape from the prison of wifeliness, motherhood, femininity, housework, beautification, isolation, when their services have been desperately needed, whether in industry or in war or in social movements. Each time practicality pulled the woman out of her prison, in a kind of work parole program, the attempt was made to push her back once the need was over, and this led to women's struggle for change. World War II had brought more women than ever before out of the home into work. By 1960, 36% of all women 16 and older, 23 million women, worked for paid wages. But although 43% of women with school-aged children worked, there were nursery schools for only 2%. The rest had to work things out themselves. Women were 50% of the voters, but even by 1967, they held 4% of the state legislative seats and 2% of the judgeships. The median income of the working woman was about one-third that of the man, and attitudes towards women did not seem to have changed much since the 20s. "There is no overt anti-feminism in our society in 1964, wrote feminist and sociologist Alice Rossi, "not because sex equality has been achieved, but because there is practically no feminist spark left among American women." In the civil rights movement of the 60s, the signs of a collective stirring began to appear. Women took the place they customarily took in social movements, in the front lines, as privates, not generals. In the office of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Atlanta, a Spelman College student named Ruby Doris Smith, who had been jailed during the sit-ins, expressed her anger at the way women were relegated to the routine office work and she was joined in her protest by two white women in SNCC, Sandra Hayden and Mary King. The men in SNCC listened to them respectfully, read the position paper they had put together asserting their rights, but did not do very much. Ella Baker, a veteran fighter from Harlem, now organizing in the South, knew the pattern. I knew from the beginning that as a woman, an older woman, in a group of ministers who are accustomed to having women largely as supporters, there was no place for me to have come into a leadership role. Nevertheless, women played a crucial role in those early dangerous years of organizing in the South and were looked on with admiration. Many of these were older women like Ella Baker and Amelia Boynton in Selma, Alabama, and Mama Dolly in Albany, Georgia. Younger women, Gloria Richardson in Maryland, Annell Ponder in Mississippi, were not only active, but leaders. Women of all ages demonstrated, went to jail. Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper in Ruleville, Mississippi, became legendary as organizer and speaker. She sang hymns. She walked picket lines with her familiar limp. As a child, she contracted polio. She roused people to excitement at mass meetings. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Around the same time, white middle-class professional women were beginning to speak up. A pioneering early book, strong and influential, was Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. In it, she wrote, "Just what was the problem that has no name? What were the words women used when they tried to express it? Sometimes a woman would say, 'I feel empty somehow, incomplete.' Or she would say, 'I feel as if I don't exist.' Sometimes, a tired feeling. I get so angry with the children, it scares me. I feel like crying without any reason." Friedan wrote out of her experience as a middle-class housewife, but what she spoke about touched something inside all women. The problem lay buried, unspoken for many years, in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone, as she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night. She was afraid to ask even of herself the silent question, "Is this all?" But on an April morning in 1959, I heard a mother of four having coffee with four other mothers in a suburban development 15 miles from New York, say in a tone of quiet desperation, "The problem." And the others knew, without words, that she was not talking about a problem with her husband or her children or her home. Suddenly they realized they all shared the same problem, the problem that has no name. They began hesitantly to talk about it. Later, after they had picked up their children at nursery school and taken them home to nap, two of the women cried in sheer relief just to know they were not alone. The mystique that Friedan spoke of was the image of the woman as mother, as wife, living through her husband, through her children, giving up her own dreams for that. She concluded, "The only way for a woman, as for a man, to find herself, to know herself as a person, is by creative work of her own." In the summer of 1964, in Macomb, Mississippi, at a Freedom House, a civil rights headquarters where people worked and lived together, the women went on strike against the men who wanted them to cook and make beds while the men went around in cars organizing. The stirring that Friedan spoke of was true of women everywhere, it seemed. By 1969, women were 40% of the entire labor force of the United States, but a substantial number of these were secretaries, cleaning women, elementary school teachers, saleswomen, waitresses, and nurses. One out of every three working women had a husband earning less than $5,000 a year. What of the women who didn't have jobs? They worked very hard at home, but this wasn't looked on as work, because in a capitalist society, or perhaps in any modern society where things and people are bought and sold for money, if work is not paid for, not given a money value, it is considered valueless. Women began to think more about this fact in the 1960s, and Margaret Benston wrote about it, The Political Economy of Women's Liberation. Women doing housework were people outside the modern economic system. Therefore, they were like serfs or peasants, she said. The women who worked in the typical woman's job, secretary, receptionist, typist, salesperson, cleaning woman, nurse, were treated to the full range of humiliations that men in subordinate positions faced at work, plus another set of humiliations stemming from being a woman. Jibes at their mental processes, sexual jokes and aggression, invisibility except as sexual objects, cold demands for more efficiency. A commercial, Guide to Clerical Time Standards, printed a question and answer column. Question: I'm a businessman, and my secretary seems to move entirely too slowly. How many times a minute should she be able to open and close a file drawer? Answer: exactly 25 times. Times for other open and close operations are 0.04 minutes for opening or closing a folder, and 0.026 minutes for opening a standard centered desk drawer. If you're worried about her chair activity, clock her against these standards. Got up from chair, 0.033 minutes. Turn in swivel chair, 0.009 minutes. A woman factory worker in New Bedford, Massachusetts in the early 70s, in a medium-sized corporation whose president's dividends from the corporation in 1970 amounted to $325,000, wrote in an organizing newspaper that 9% of the workers in her department were women, but all the supervisors were men. A few years ago, I was suspended for 3 days from work because my children were still young and I had to take time off when they were sick. They want people who keep quiet, squeal on one another, and are very good little robots. The fact that many have to take nerve pills before starting their day, and a week doesn't go by that there aren't two or three people who break down and cry, doesn't mean a thing to them. She added, "But times are changing, and from now on, more people will speak out and demand from their so-called bosses that they be treated the way the bosses themselves would like to be treated." Times indeed were changing. Around 1967, women in the various movements, civil rights, Students for a Democratic Society, anti-war groups, began meeting as women, and in early 1968, at a women's anti-war meeting in Washington, hundreds of women carrying torches paraded to the Arlington National Cemetery and staged the burial of traditional womanhood. At this point, and later too, there was some disagreement among women, and even more among men, on whether women should battle on specifically women's issues or just take part in general movements against racism, war, capitalism. But the idea of a feminist focus grew. In the fall of 1968, a group called Radical Women attracted national attention when they protested the selection of Miss America, which they called an image that oppresses women. They all threw bras, girdles, curlers, false eyelashes, wigs, and other things they called women's garbage into a freedom trash can. A sheep was crowned Miss America. More important, people were beginning to speak of women's liberation. Some of the New York Radical Women shortly afterward formed WITCH, Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, and its members, dressed as witches, appeared suddenly on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. A leaflet put out by WITCH in New York said, "Witch lives and laughs in every woman. She is the free part of each of us. Beneath the shy smiles, the acquiescence to absurd male domination, the makeup or flesh-suffocating clothes our sick society demands. There is no joining witch. If you are a woman and dare to look within yourself, you are a witch. You make your own rules." Witch in Washington, D.C., protested at the United Fruit Company for the corporation's activities in the Third World and its treatment of its women office workers. In Chicago, it protested the firing of a radical feminist teacher named Marlene Dixon. Poor women, black women, expressed the universal problem of women in their own way. In 1964, Robert Coles, Children of Crisis, interviewed a black woman from the South recently moved to Boston, who spoke of the desperation of her life, the difficulty of finding happiness. "To me, having a baby inside me is the only time I'm really alive." Without talking specifically about their problems as women, many women, among the poor, did as they had always done, quietly organized neighborhood people to right injustices, to get needed services. In the mid-1960s, 10,000 black people in a community in Atlanta called Vine City joined together to help one another. They set up a thrift shop, a nursery, a medical clinic, monthly family suppers, a newspaper, a family counseling service. One of the organizers, Helen Howard, told Gerda Lerner in Black Women in White America about it. "I organized this neighborhood organization. Two men and six ladies started it. That was a hard pull. A lot of people joined in later. For about 5 months, we had meetings pretty near every night. We learned how to work with other people. A lot of people were afraid to really do anything. You were afraid to go to the city hall or ask for anything. You didn't even ask the landlord for anything. You were afraid of him. Then we had meetings, and then we weren't afraid so much anymore. The way we got this playground, we blocked off the street, wouldn't let anything come through. We wouldn't let the trolley bus come through. The whole neighborhood was in it. Took record players and danced. It went on for a week. We didn't get arrested. There was too many of us. So then the city put up this playground for the kids." A woman named Patricia Robinson wrote a pamphlet called Poor Black Woman, in which she connected the problems of women with the need for basic social change. Rebellion by poor black women, the bottom of a class hierarchy heretofore not discussed, places the question of what kind of society will the poor black woman demand and struggle for. Already she demands the right to have birth control, like middle-class black and white women. She is aware that it takes two to oppress, and that she and other poor people no longer are submitting to oppression, in this case genocide. She allies herself with the have-nots in the wider world and their revolutionary struggles. She had been forced by historical conditions to withdraw the children from male dominance and to educate and support them herself. In this very process, male authority and exploitation are seriously weakened. Further, she realizes that the children will be used as all poor children have been used through history, as poorly paid mercenaries fighting to keep or put an elite group in power. Through these steps, she has begun to question aggressive male domination and the class society which enforces it, capitalism. In 1970, Dorothy Bolden, a laundry worker in Atlanta and mother of six, told Y in 1968 she began organizing women doing housework into the National Domestic Workers Union. She said, "I think women should have a voice in making decisions in their community for betterment. Because this woman in the slum is scuffling hard, and she's got a very good, intelligent mind to do things, and she's been overlooked for so many years, I think she should have a voice." Women tennis players organized. A woman fought to be a jockey, won her case, became the first woman jockey. Women artists picketed the Whitney Museum, charging sex discrimination in a sculptor's show. Women journalists picketed the Gridiron Club in Washington, which excluded women. By the start of 1974, women's studies programs existed at 78 institutions, and about 2,000 courses on women were being offered at about 500 campuses. Women's magazines and newspapers began appearing, locally and nationally, and books on women's history and the movement came out in such numbers that some bookstores had special sections for them. The very jokes on television, some sympathetic, some caustic, showed how national was the effect of the movement. Certain television commercials, which women felt humiliated them, were eliminated after protest. In 1967, after lobbying by women's groups, President Johnson signed an executive order banning sex discrimination in federally connected employment, and in the years that followed, women's groups demanded that this be enforced. Over 1,000 suits were initiated by NOW, National Organization for Women, formed in 1966, against U.S. corporations charging sex discrimination. The right to abortion became a major issue. Before 1970, about 1 million abortions were done every year, of which only about 10,000 were legal. Perhaps a third of the women having illegal abortions, mostly poor people, had to be hospitalized for complications. How many thousands died as a result of these illegal abortions, no one really knows. But the illegalization of abortion clearly worked against the poor, for the rich could manage either to have their baby or to have their abortion under safe conditions. Court actions to do away with the laws against abortions were begun in over 20 states between 1968 and 1970, and public opinion grew stronger for the right of women to decide for themselves without government interference. In the book Sisterhood is Powerful, an important collection of women's writing around 1970, an article by Lucinda Sisler, Unfinished Business, Birth Control, said that abortion is a woman's right. No one can veto her decision and compel her to bear a child against her will. In the spring of 1969, a Harris poll showed that 64% of those polled thought the decision on abortion was a private matter. Finally, in early 1973, the Supreme Court decided, Roe versus Wade, Doe versus Bolton, that the state could prohibit abortions only in the last 3 months of pregnancy, that it could regulate abortion for health purposes during the second 3 months of pregnancy, and during the first 3 months, a woman and her doctor had the right to decide. There was a push for child care centers, and although women did not succeed in getting much help from government, thousands of cooperative child care centers were set up. Women also began to speak openly for the first time about the problem of rape. Each year, 50,000 rapes were reported, and many more were unreported. Women began taking self-defense courses. There were protests against the way police treated women, interrogated them, insulted them, when women filed rape charges. A book by Susan Brown Miller, Against Our Will, was widely read. It is a powerful, indignant history and analysis of rape, suggesting self-defense, individual or collective. Brown Miller wrote, "Fighting back, on a multiplicity of levels, that is the activity we must engage in, together, if we, women, are to redress the imbalance and rid ourselves and men of the ideology of rape. Rape can be eradicated, not merely controlled or avoided on an individual basis, but the approach must be long-range and cooperative and must have the understanding and goodwill of many men as well as women." Many women were active in trying to get a constitutional amendment, ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, passed by enough states. But it seemed clear that even if it became law, it would not be enough, that what women had accomplished had come through organization, action, protest. Even where the law was helpful, it was helpful only if backed by action. Shirley Chisholm, a black congresswoman, said, "The law cannot do it for us. We must do it for ourselves. Women in this country must become revolutionaries. We must refuse to accept the old, the traditional roles and stereotypes. We must replace the old, negative thoughts about our femininity with positive thoughts and positive action." Perhaps the most profound effect of the women's movement of the 60s, beyond the actual victories on abortion and job equality, was called consciousness raising, often done in women's groups, which met in homes all across the country. This meant the rethinking of roles, the rejection of inferiority, the confidence in self, a bond of sisterhood, a new solidarity of mother and daughter. The Atlanta poet Esta Seton wrote her life. "This is the picture that keeps forming in my mind. My young mother, barely 17, cooking their kosher dinner on the coal stove that first winter in Vermont. And my father, mute in his feelings, except when he shouted, eating to show his love." 50 years later, her blue eyes would grow cold with the shock of that gray house and the babies one after another and the doctor who said, "If you don't want any more children, move out of the house." For the first time, the sheer biological uniqueness of women was openly discussed. Some theorists, Shulamith Firestone in The Dialectics of Sex, for instance, thought this was more fundamental to their oppression than any particular economic system. It was liberating to talk frankly about what had for so long been secret, hidden, cause for shame and embarrassment. Menstruation, masturbation, menopause, abortion, lesbianism. One of the most influential books to appear in the early 70s was a book assembled by 11 women in the Boston Women's Health Book Collective called Our Bodies, Ourselves. It contained an enormous amount of practical information on women's anatomy, on sexuality and sexual relationships, on lesbianism, on nutrition and health, on rape, self-defense, venereal disease, birth control, abortion, pregnancy, childbirth, and menopause. More important even than the information, the charts, the photos, the candid exploration of the previously unmentioned was the mood of exuberance throughout the book, the enjoyment of the body, the happiness with the newfound understanding, the new sisterhood with young women, middle-aged women, older women. they quoted the English suffragette Christabel Pankhurst. Remember the dignity of your womanhood. Do not appeal, do not beg, do not grovel. Take courage, join hands, stand beside us, fight with us. The fight began, many women were saying, with the body, which seemed to be the beginning of the exploitation of women, as sex plaything, weak and incompetent, as pregnant woman, helpless, as middle-aged woman, no longer considered beautiful, as older woman, to be ignored, set aside. A biological prison had been created by men and society. As Adrienne Rich said, of women born, women are controlled by lashing us to our bodies. She wrote, I have a very clear, keen memory of myself the day after I was married. I was sweeping a floor. Probably the floor did not really need to be swept. Probably I simply did not know what else to do with myself. But as I swept that floor, I thought, now I am a woman. This is an age-old action. This is what women have always done. I felt I was bending to some ancient form, too ancient to question. This is what women have always done. As soon as I was visibly and clearly pregnant, I felt, for the first time in my adolescent and adult life, not guilty. The atmosphere of approval in which I was bathed, even by strangers on the street, it seemed, was like an aura I carried with me, in which doubts, fears, misgivings met with absolute denial. This is what women have always done. Rich said women could use the body as a resource rather than a destiny. Patriarchal systems, she said, whether under capitalism or socialism, limited women's bodies to their own needs. She discussed the training of passivity in women. Generations of schoolgirls were raised on Little Women, where Jo is told by her mother, I am angry nearly every day of my life, Jo, but I have learned not to show it, and I still hope to learn not to feel it, though it may take me another 40 years to do so. Male doctors used instruments to bring out children, replacing the sensitive hands of midwives in the era of anesthetized, technologized childbirth. Rich disagreed with her fellow feminist Firestone, who wanted to change the biological inevitability of childbirth because it is painful and a source of subordination. She wants, under different social conditions, to make childbirth a source of physical and emotional joy. One could not talk of Freud's ignorance of women, Rich said, as his one blind spot, which implied that in other matters his vision was clear. Such ignorance distorts all. There is a dilemma of the body. I know no woman, virgin, mother, lesbian, married, celibate, whether she earns her keep as a housewife, a cocktail waitress, or a scanner of brainwaves, for whom her body is not a fundamental problem. Its clouded meaning, its fertility, its desire, its so-called frigidity, its bloody speech, its silences, its changes and mutilations, its rapes and ripenings. Her reply to this, the repossession of our bodies, a world in which every woman is the presiding genius of her own body, as a basis for bringing forth not just children, but new visions, new meanings, a new world. For most women who were not intellectuals, the question was even more immediate. How to eliminate hunger, suffering, subordination, humiliation in the here and now? A woman named Johnny Tillman wrote in 1972, I'm a woman. I'm a black woman. I'm a poor woman. I'm a fat woman. I'm a middle-aged woman. And I'm on welfare. I have raised 6 children. I grew up in Arkansas, worked there for 15 years in a laundry, moved to California. In 1963, I got too sick to work anymore. Friends helped me to go on welfare. Welfare's like a traffic accident. It can happen to anybody, but especially it happens to women. And that is why welfare is a women's issue. For a lot of middle-class women in this country, women's liberation is a matter of concern. For women on welfare, it's a matter of survival. Welfare, she said, was like a super sexist marriage. You trade in a man for the man. The man runs everything, controls your money. She and other welfare mothers organized a national welfare rights organization. They urged that women be paid for their work, housekeeping, child rearing. No woman can be liberated until all women get off their knees. And the problem of women was the germ of a solution, not only for their oppression, but for everybody's. The control of women in society was ingeniously effective. It was not done directly by the state. Instead, the family was used, men to control women, women to control children, all to be preoccupied with one another, to turn to one another for help, to blame one another for trouble, to do violence to one another when things weren't going right. Why could this not be turned around? Could women liberating themselves, children freeing themselves, men and women beginning to understand one another, find the source of their common oppression outside rather than in one another? Perhaps then they could create nuggets of strength in their own relationships, millions of pockets of insurrection. They could revolutionize thought and behavior in exactly that seclusion of family privacy which the system had counted on to do its work of control and indoctrination. And together, instead of at odds, male, female, parents, children, they could undertake the changing of society itself. It was a time of uprisings. If there could be a rebellion inside that most subtle and complex of prisons, the family, it was reasonable that there be rebellions in the most brutal and obvious of prisons, the penitentiary system itself. In the 60s and early 70s, those rebellions multiplied. They also took on an unprecedented political character and the ferocity of class war coming to a climax at Attica, New York, in September of 1971. The prison had arisen in the United States as an attempt at Quaker reform to replace mutilation, hanging, exile, the traditional punishments during colonial times. The prison was intended, through isolation, to produce repentance and salvation, but prisoners went insane and died in that isolation. By mid-19th century, the prison was based on hard labor, along with various punishments, sweat boxes, iron yokes, solitary. The approach was summed up by the warden at the Ossining, New York Penitentiary. In order to reform a criminal, you must first break his spirit. That approach persisted. Prison officials would convene annually to congratulate themselves on the progress being made. The president of the American Correctional Association, delivering the annual address in 1966, described the new edition of the Manual of Correctional Standards. It permits us to linger, if we will, at the gates of correctional Valhalla, with an abiding pride in the sense of a job superbly done. We may be proud, we may be satisfied, we may be content. He said this just after, in the midst of, and just before the most intense series of prison uprisings the country had ever seen. There had always been prison riots. A wave of them in the 1920s ended with a riot at Clinton, New York, a prison of 1,600 inmates, which was suppressed with three prisoners killed. Between 1950 and 1953, more than 50 major riots occurred in American prisons. In the early 1960s, prisoners on a work gang in Georgia smashing rocks used the same sledgehammers to break their legs to call attention to their situation of daily brutality. At San Quentin Prison in California, which housed 4,000 prisoners, there was a series of revolts in the late 60s. A race riot in 1967, a united black-white general strike in early 1968 that shut down almost all the prison industries, and then a second strike that summer. At the Queens House of Detention on Long Island in New York in the fall of 1970, prisoners took over the jail, took hostages, issued demands. The prisoners' negotiating committee included four blacks, one Puerto Rican, one white. They demanded immediate bail hearings on 47 cases that they said were examples of racism in the granting of bail. Judges came inside the prison, granted some paroles and reductions, and the hostages were released. But when the prisoners continued to hold out, police stormed the jail with tear gas and clubs, and the revolt was over. Around the same time, in November 1970, in Folsom Prison in California, a work stoppage began which became the longest prison strike in the history of the United States. Most of the 2,400 prisoners held out in their cells for 19 days without food in the face of threats and intimidation. The strike was broken with a combination of force and deception, and four of the prisoners were sent on a 14-hour ride to another prison, shackled and naked on the floor of a van. One of the rebels wrote, "The spirit of awareness has grown. The seed has been planted." The prisons in the United States had long been an extreme reflection of the American system itself. The stark life differences between rich and poor, the racism, the use of victims against one another, the lack of resources of the underclass to speak out, the endless reforms that changed little. Dostoevsky once said, "The degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons." It had long been true, and prisoners knew this better than anyone, that the poorer you were, the more likely you were to end up in jail. This was not just because the poor committed more crimes. In fact, they did. The rich did not have to commit crimes to get what they wanted. The laws were on their side. But when the rich did commit crimes, they often were not prosecuted. And if they were, they could get out on bail, hire clever lawyers, get better treatment from judges. Somehow the jails ended up full of poor black people.